Welcome to MHA's podcast number 8. Good afternoon, Brennan. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Good afternoon, Stephen, and good to be with all our listeners.
Brennan, we are now 6 months into this recession, which started in February, but the markets are behaving as if we are out of the recession, as exemplified by stock markets in the U.S. soaring since late March and yield curves starting to steepen. Do you agree that we are out of the recession?
No, I don't agree. My central case by far is that the recession has considerably further to go with the second leg of recession ahead. All business cycle recessions have common essence, but very different particulars. The different particular in this case was the supply shock of a pandemic. And of course, since the summer, there has been a relaxation or removal of lockdown restrictions, which has gone along with less supply impediments and a rebound in the economic aggregates, such as we've seen. But the essence of recession is a lot of malinvestment revealed from previous period of asset inflation. That malinvestment in turn shows up in severely damaged collateral, which weakens or in fact fails the banking system and credit institutions. And that all goes along with pronounced and sustained weakness in business spending. We have seen considerable weakness in business spending since February. I believe that's got a lot further and deeper to go as we get the credit problems manifesting themselves much more starkly in the months ahead.
However, we read and hear about how extreme monetary stimulus, led by the Fed, has come to the rescue of the pandemic-struck global economy and will prevent any relapse of the economic recovery underway. Could this mother of all monetary stimuli then prove to be hopelessly flawed?
Yes, it could be very flawed and is likely to be flawed. The central banks led by the Fed cannot wipe away the solvency risk related to all the malinvestment and its collateral damage. The Fed and the other central banks have been very successful in spawning two big narratives, and the first narrative relating to the idea that solvency risk has been removed, and hence a huge amount of funds internationally going into high yield and risky credit. That is very likely to short circuit and come to an end as the process of bad debt manifestation deepens going forward.
Then why does the market think that the radical monetary policy is going to prevent a second downturn?
Well, that's very much the narrative as at present. And we've certainly seen a lot of speculative froth in a range of pandemic stocks. But high monopoly rents and monopoly profits in those areas are not going to wipe clear the malinvestment and the damage beneath the surface or quite visible to the credit institutions and banks. I think there has been a process where the high-flying pandemic stocks, by a process of negative contagion, have pulled up the financial stocks and other securities related to those institutions or prevented their fall being much greater. So there is a sort of comfort being established as a result of what's visibly being seen in markets, but that is very likely going to prove a mirage.
Can you tell us anything about how the credit and likely banking crisis will erupt and how the pandemic stock bubble will burst then?
Well, on the credit institutions and how the narrative about solvency risk being solved is going to undo itself, there's two possibilities here. One, we get a big negative credit event, which shocks investors into seeing that solvency risk is very much there. Or we get growing amount of concern amongst investors as the bad news deepens with many bankruptcies and higher unemployment into the autumn, in Europe in particular. And that all leads in turn to a sudden plunge in bank equity values, which in turn spears concern about the credit institutions more fundamentally.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the plunge in equity prices of banks. If we look at Europe in particular, where you clearly think the problem will have its epicenter, and we look at some of the major players, it is quite shocking already how far we are off the pre-pandemic highs. Lloyds Bank is off 67%, Santander 50%, HSBC 47%, SocGen almost 60%, Bank Paribas, one of the better performers, off 34.5%, and UniCredit and Barclays both off 45%. It's actually quite interesting when we look at the Swiss banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, have performed relatively well, off 10 and 22% respectively. And we know that they've shrunk their loan books considerably since the last crisis. So there's already a fair amount of stress and being priced into the European banks, but it sounds like you think it's going to be actually quite a bit worse what's priced in.
And Stephen, you asked me earlier how the pandemic stock bubble is going to, or boom is going to reverse. And very definite scenario is that a plunge in financial equities led by Europe will in fact be the trigger to pulling down the pandemic stocks. That's more likely the way in which the pandemic stock boom is going to come to an end than investors suddenly waking up and questioning why on earth they were valuing those stocks on the basis of 30 years ahead of certain monopoly rents.
Brendan, you described recently in Chief Powell's Jackson Hole speech as the latest act in a long-run Fed comedy show under the title of The Emperor's New Clothes. What do you mean by this?
Emperor's New Clothes, because in fact, the Fed has no reliable means or precise means to accomplish any path for prices and inflation over the medium or long run. We're in a totally dysfunctional monetary system now with no anchor that's been systematically destroyed by central bank radical action over the last two decades. So there's no high-powered money aggregate out there which the Fed can reliably steer towards getting to any price objective. What it's left with in achieving price objectives over time is a very blunt and imprecise instrument of interest rate manipulation, plus relying on a variety of inertias, particularly of price expectations. So when the Fed boasts that it's now going to achieve an average inflation rate of 2% over time, that's a very empty boast. It's really what happens to inflation is going to be far beyond its control in many respects.
Was there anything new in his latest show? And did that justify a further fall of the US dollar? We see the dollar basically selling off every day at the moment, including today. Very strong trend.
The idea or the proposal that the Fed was going to adopt an average inflation rate of 2% as objective has been around for quite some time, as highlighted indeed by Chief Powell himself in previous remarks. So there's not much new there. I would say if anything new came out, it's just the starkness of a comment and what it all boils down to. In fact, if you look through all the imperfections I've been describing about, is decision by the Fed that as inflation does begin to pick up in the eventual post-pandemic boom, whenever that is, the Fed's going to be doing nothing to withstand that rise in inflation for a considerable time, meaning that the danger of another episode of high inflation, such as in the 1970s, is very real.
Brendan, in short, what is your view of the new inflation and employment targets, along in particular with the new financial stability aim?
Well, financial stability aim is a complete joke, sick joke, in the sense that Fed policies in the last few decades have created huge financial instability. And if we're anywhere near right about this mother of all financial stimuli failing, we're going to see a repeat of a very severe financial instability in the not too distant future. As regards employment aims, the Fed itself has pretty well told us now at Jackson Hole that its old econometric relationships, including the notorious Phillips curve, no longer work. So it's not at all clear how, if at all, they're targeting or hoping to influence by monetary policy employment.
And the rise in long-term yields, which the speech prompted, does that have much further to go?
Well, the rise in long-term yields, in technical terms for far-out forward rates, does reflect heightened concern about inflation in the distant future. So what we've had since Jackson Hole is a further rise in inflation expectations whilst forward real yields have declined. But none of this is dramatic. We're talking about 10 basis points or so since the Fed announcements.
Do you think, Brendan, that there is a more general weakness of the dollar now setting in? If we look back during our lifetime, there have been two major U.S. dollar bear markets. The first was after the signing of the Plaza Accord, which started in February 85 and had a pretty much straight fall to December 87, dropping 48% in that period. And that bear market didn't end until August 92, down 53%. And the second major U.S. dollar bear market we experienced started in January 02, straight line down to December 04, so also about 3 years, dropping 34% and ultimately ending in February 08, down 39% from its peak. And when I look at this current sell-off, it looks very similar in spirit to those two dollar bear markets in their early stages. So could this be the beginning of a multi-year 40, 50% fall in the dollar?
Well, first of all, Stephen, as we discussed in a previous podcast, I hesitate to call this a generalized weakness of a dollar. In recent months, what we've actually seen has been a fairly stable, if volatile, yen-dollar relationship, a dollar which has stayed firm against most of the emerging market currencies, but European currency rise, including the British pound, euro, and Swiss franc against the dollar. So it's been a Eurocentric weakness of the dollar. No general weakness. Now, the second point about history and previous episodes of dollar weakness of 30% plus, as Daniel Kahneman tells us, the sample size is in the laboratory of history are very small, and two is not a big sample size to be saying anything. In addition, these two previous episodes of sustained dollar falls that you were describing had a very different background to today, in that in both previous episodes, we had second international money, an alternative international money to the dollar, which really was a safe haven or seemed to be a safe haven. In the case of the 1980s, that was the Deutschmark. And in the early 2000s, it was the euro, which at that time, albeit falsely, was regarded as the new European Deutschmark, and the head of the European Central Bank at the time, Trichet, seemed to be a hard money person. So when the dollar came under monetary threat from an inflating Fed, global funds rushed into the Deutschmark or euro, creating these huge currency swings you've referred to. In today's world, I don't think anyone in their right mind considers the euro under Madame Lagarde as a sound money alternative to the dollar. In fact, if anything, its monetary policies are even more extreme than the Fed. So I don't expect or believe that the present monetary inflation dangers which the Fed is creating is going to trigger giant flows into alternative monies and create these big swings we've had in the past.
Thank you, Brendan. And for our listeners who are interested in key technical levels, the euro, we pointed out in our last GMV, was bullish above 115.80 and is trading just below 120 now. The next major resistance, which we think will be difficult to break through, is 120, 120 to 120, 140. So that's something to keep an eye out for. In sterling versus the dollar, the next major resistance area is around 136, give or take about 30 pips either side. On dollar yen, 140.80 is a strong support area. And any stress coming back into markets around equities and credit, we think the yen will be the outperformer. And in fact, during this period of asset bubble, the yen has been relatively weak against the euro. And the next major resistance in the euro yen is 127.80. And it would take a break below 123.50 to see euro yen weakness. And speaking of the weakness of the dollar, it is, of course, a factor in the U.S. stock market rise. However, when we look at the S&P in euro and yen in sterling terms, it's not as happy a chart and is up a much smaller amount this year. And against gold, it's down. Is there food for thought here, Brendan?
Definitely, that when we compare asset prices and fluctuations across the globe, we do and should use a common currency to compare. And that also influences judgment of financial equities, which, as we discussed earlier, the severe fall in Europe of some financial equities is somewhat less so if you measure them in dollars.
That's a good point, Brendan. Let's return to this item of the pandemic stock boom, which you touched on already. Aren't the major issues here the two key issues? One, whether the monopoly profits are sustainable in the long run, and two, whether the patterns of demand shift and momentum during the pandemic are sustained?
Absolutely. And when you look at the valuations of big tech, the key ingredient here is exponential growth in monopoly rents over many decades. Now, if a history of US economy is anything to go by, we don't, in fact, see multi-decade periods in which monopoly rents increase. The US has done a very effective job via both antitrust policies and through the emergence of new technologies and spontaneous competition to break regularly the power of monopolies and allow the full force of dynamic capitalism to bring prosperity to its people. If, in fact, the market is anything like correct, that this time is going to be different, and that these monopoly rents really are going to go on and on, it would be a pretty dismal day and outlook for the prosperity of the U.S. economy.
Brendan, you've been telling me that there is a 70% chance of credit and banking crisis, so obviously your central scenario, and only a 10% chance of the asset inflation continuing through to post-pandemic boom with no second wave of recession. So what happens if we avoid credit crisis until the post-pandemic boom arrives? Is that possible?
It's possible in under circumstances, for example, which would include near miraculous, strong, sustained economic boom after the pandemic, rather than a considerable period during which there'll be fairly weak business spending until the malinvestment of a previous boom is somehow throttled out of the system and new investment opportunity has time to blossom. But yes, we could have that type of miracle. And as you say, one might put something like 10% probability on that.
But if we, you know, take a look at what's going on right now, there's this construction boom in North America, lumber prices have exploded, exponential increase during the past few months, and commodity prices in general, apart from oil, are on the rise. So why at this point are you so pessimistic about a relapse of economic activity?
The strength of commodity prices outside oil clearly is related in part to optimism at present about the Chinese economy, which may be growing as much as 10% per annum through this second half of the year. There's many question marks over the sustainability of that. As regards the construction boom, it's very early days to say that the US economy is going into a sustained construction boom, residential construction boom, such as what we saw, and that was a malinvestment exaggeration in the early part of this century when we had residential investment in the US 3 or 4% of GDP above its normal level. What we've had so far is a month or two of strong bounce back of residential construction and indeed some commercial construction, reflecting a lot of refiguring of existing space to deal with the realities of COVID-19. If indeed there's another leg of recession coming and a deepening of the credit financial difficulties, that's surely going to count against this early promise of construction upturn materializing anytime soon.
Is there a good example of virulent asset inflation in the midst of recession in previous history that did not end particularly well?
I don't think we've had anything to the degree of this speculative frenzy in the midst of a recession before. But there have been examples in the same category, and the two I can think of are the oil and commodity boom or bubble in spring and summer 2008, when the recession globally in the US and Europe had already started the previous November. And of course, after that oil and commodity boom or bubble, we went on to the financial crisis and Great Recession from autumn 2008 onwards. Further back, there was the spring rebound of Wall Street in 1930 after the 1929 crash, which went on to the credit and banking crisis, culminating in Credit Anstalt and the German banking collapse of summer 1931.
Brendan, to wrap up, as we enter the autumn, what do you think we should be looking out for with regards to monetary policy from the major central banks?
Well, in the case of the US, not a lot more, unless, of course, we encounter severe market circumstances. I think the good news from the US side is that despite all the radicalism unveiled at Jackson Hole, the Fed is not crossing the borders into yield curve control or negative interest rates, two features which plague the European and Japanese monetary environment. Turning to Europe, is a good player in the beggar your neighbor currency policies, meaning by good, it's a forceful player. And I expect European central banks to be playing that role again without, of course, admitting anything like that in public. So yes, the European Central Bank will be accentuating and adding to its QE and other programs with the unstated intent of getting the euro back down. And in the case of the Bank of England, I fully expect this central bank to be initiating policies with the effect of getting sterling down as the easiest way of stimulating an economy which will be facing very severe headwinds from sharply rising unemployment as the furlough schemes and other employment support schemes run out in the autumn.
Thank you very much, Brendan. This brings our eighth podcast to conclusion. Thank you very much for listening, and we hope that you enjoyed it and found it to be insightful and interesting. Please look out for our next Viewpoint, which will be published early next week, and will be focused on the Fed's latest Jackson Hole show, also known as The Emperor's New Clothes. In the meantime, please visit our website, macrohedgeadvisors.com, and do get in touch with us if you would like to learn more about full access to our insights, bespoke services, and Viewpoint archives.